It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll talk to an underwater photographer who specializes in shipwreck diving.
First, today, the Ferguson Commission unveiled a nearly 200-page report of recommended changes to address racial disparities in the Missouri town.
The story begins last August when Michael Brown, an unarmed black teenager, was shot and killed by a white Ferguson police officer. Brown's death set off riots and violence in Ferguson just outside St. Louis. It also brought up deep questions about race relations there and across the United States.
In November, Missouri Governor Jay Nixon appointed a Ferguson Commission, a group tasked with looking at racial and economic gaps in the St. Louis region and developing policy recommendations.
Nearly 10 months and 20,000 hours of work later, the Ferguson Commission unveiled its report, Forward Through Ferguson, A Path Toward Racial Equity. The report includes 189 calls to action.
Jason Rosenbaum is with us to talk about this report and how it's being received in the St. Louis community. He's a reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me back.
So tell us a little bit about the goal of the Ferguson Commission going in.
The Ferguson Commission's goal was to take an unvarnished look at the racial, economic, and educational divisions within the St. Louis region and present Missouri Governor Jay Nixon with a host of policy recommendations. And from reading just the first pages of the report, it doesn't pull any punches. It talks openly about how St. Louis has underserved and at times discriminated against the African-American population. And then later in the report, it provides over 40 signature recommendations to alter how St. Louis polices itself, educates its children, provides health care to the most vulnerable, as well as provide a more robust and comprehensive economic development strategy for the poor. So it's pretty comprehensive. It goes beyond law enforcement, but law enforcement is clearly the centerpiece of this report.
And you mentioned the blunt language of the report initially, and one of the lines, we have not moved beyond race. What kind of language did the committee use to talk about the city's issue with race and where Ferguson is?
It was purposeful because as Commission Co-Chair Starsky Wilson said at the last meeting of the Ferguson Commission, many other commissions and blue ribbon panels have been set up throughout American history to take stock of racially charged riots. And oftentimes they didn't really amount to anything because it was all about economic development and economic issues. And it really didn't hit on some of the latent racial and economic divisions and tensions within that the particular communities. And the Ferguson Commission was trying to avoid that. They were trying to paint what they felt was a plain picture of a divided region, so they're not papering over some of these tensions and decades-old problems. And many of the solutions hit at these problems, especially ones that deal with police departments, how they're trained toward minority groups, how many police departments there should be, and who should investigate police-involved killings. All of those things have been of great concern to the African-American community throughout the St. Louis region. And I think that the tone that was struck at the beginning was trying to send a message that those types of calls for action were not going to be ignored.
Was that language in the initial pages of the report the kind of thing you think that could ruffle feathers, or is it the kind of unvarnished look that you were saying that the commission report was looking for from the beginning?
I think it's the second option. I think people who have lived in St. Louis for a while know that we are racially divided. I mean, although I guess there's a lot of cities that say that they're the quote-unquote most segregated, it's pretty much indisputable that St. Louis as a city and as a county and as a region has been segregated, and many of the African-American communities, although not all, have been underserved and are struggling. And it's self-evident. In some ways, you don't need a report to know that for a fact, but sometimes it needs to be said and declared in kind of official bold-faced font to get the point across and say, this is a major problem that is holding the St. Louis region back. And unless we face it and perhaps deal within ourselves to get past some of the cultural attitudes that we've had, it's as I said, it's going to hold the region back and beyond just any policy things that need to be done.
We're talking with Jason Rosenbaum right now, reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. He's joining us to talk about the recommendations made from the Ferguson Commission just released today. And let's get into some of the findings here, the recommendations from this commission. And you said the centerpiece was law enforcement. What did the commission call for when it came to law enforcement and improving relations with the community and with minority communities in general?
The first big thing is appointing the Attorney General of Missouri as a special prosecutor whenever there's a police-involved killing. And it also would have the Missouri Highway Patrol be the police agency that investigates a crime. That obviously became a big issue after Michael Brown's shooting death because St. Louis County Prosecutor Bob McCullough was kind of in the public consciousness because people thought he was too favorable to law enforcement. So that's one major aspect. The other one that comes to mind is St. Louis as a region has many small police departments, and many of them have been heavily criticized for focusing primarily on revenue collection and not necessarily public safety. And as a result, many African Americans, and particularly poor African Americans, have been the victims of tickets and just overall racial profiling. So the commission calls for consolidation of some of those police departments. It also calls for more robust training for how police deal with minority groups, how they handle demonstrations, and how they handle implicit cultural biases. So again, law enforcement is not the only thing that's in this report, but it is clearly the thing that's front and center that's going to be maybe talked about the most.
And when you look at that list that you just gave us, are there propositions there that strike you as more or less viable than others?
I think that some of the proposals that I just talked about probably could be done internally. For example, increasing the amount of training doesn't necessarily need like the legislature to occur. There's currently a study going on for the agency in Missouri that handles standards for police officers, and they may just recommend changes to training on their own. Other things like appointing special prosecutors or consolidation may run into some pretty serious political opposition both locally and in the state legislature. In fact, we actually talked with Bob McCullough about the idea of appointing special prosecutors for police-involved killings, and he thinks it's a misguided and frankly undemocratic idea. In his view, the voters in Missouri elect prosecutors to prosecute things that are within their jurisdictions. And if they don't feel someone is fair toward a police officer that may or may not be indicted, in his view, they just shouldn't vote for him, or they should vote for them out of office. So although Bob McCullough has become a controversial figure, he's also a very big political figure within not only Missouri Democratic politics, but also within the state legislature. And if he and other prosecutors start raising alarms about that particular proposal, it may have a tough time getting through the Republican-controlled Missouri General Assembly.
And what did the Ferguson Commission recommend when it comes to schools and some of the economic aspects of this?
They suggested investing heavily in early childhood education and putting health centers that deal with comprehensive mental health within schools. They also recommend a more robust policy to cultivate affordable housing. They want to raise the minimum wage. They want to expand Medicaid under the auspices of the Affordable Care Act, which has not been done here by the state legislature. Some of those things, I think, probably have more support in general than others. Like, for example, low-income housing tax credits generally have support of both parties. But expanding Medicaid and raising the minimum wage are frankly non-starters in the Republican-controlled legislature. And it would probably require a pretty drastic shift in political sensibilities for that to actually occur.
Now, the lieutenant governor in Missouri had expressed some skepticism about the efficacy of the commission and the staying power of its findings. In general, what kind of reception has this commission's report gotten so far?
I think some are optimistic that even if the legislature is not willing to enact some of the recommendations, the commission members and the people that recommended some of the ideas may go into their respective spheres and implement them without the legislature. But as far as you mentioned, the lieutenant governor, while the lieutenant governor does not necessarily have a super powerful legislative hand in Missouri politics. He does sometimes represent what can be the conventional wisdom, and he has basically been concerned the whole time that this is going to end up like many other riot commission reports that are just going to gather dust on shelves and not really amount to much of anything. And frankly, it's not just Republicans who are fearful of that. At the last Ferguson Commission meeting, there was an attorney from Cincinnati named Al Gerhardstein who had been involved in changing the police departments in his city after racially charged riots. And he says without a court order kind of implementing some of the changes within the Ferguson Commission, it may be very difficult to actually make them stick. And, you know, in this case, we're talking not only about one city, but multiple cities that need a legislative solution. And I think what the Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder was expressing was a worry that just some of them are not going to find favor in a Republican legislature.
Jason, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Jason Rosenbaum, reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. He joined us to talk about the recommendations from the Ferguson Commission just released today.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll look at the way state and national media outlets covered Scott Walker's campaigns for governor and president.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Storms can be as thrilling as they are scary. Gales on Lake Michigan send some people into hiding, others, like Wendy Lutzky, to the lakeshore.
Gales on Lake Michigan can be as destructive as hurricanes, attracting thrill seekers as curious as the tornado chasers on the open prairies. When a gale warning alert pops up repeatedly on my phone, I know it's going to be a doozy. People have died and ships have disappeared in gales like this on the Great Lakes. But the gravity of that doesn't stop people from being drawn to the water's edge to witness it for themselves. So, based on personal experience, here's what you do. Choose a spot on the shore that's exposed to the elements but won't put you in imminent danger of being swept into the waves. Pull off your hat or loosen your hood and face yourself into the wind. Feel the wind pull your hair back and let the airborne waves splatter your face. If the wind gives you a shove backwards and forces you to shout to be heard by the person near you, you've passed the test. You'll be rewarded by waves that dwarf man-made piers and lighthouses, ramming and rolling over them with ease, creating a splash that temporarily suspends the water twice as high as the original wave. Days or weeks from now, someone will discover that parts of a shipwreck once hidden are now exposed, or one that was exposed has now been swallowed by the shifting sands. Provided you're not a target for flying debris and there's no lightning, you know you can stand out in it for as long as your crazy obsession lasts. The word awesome may be overused in our American vocabulary, but in some circumstances, like this, it's the first word that slips past your lips as the wind makes you squint and the waves crash at your feet. While I was thrilled to be out during the gale, I was just as interested in its aftermath. Evidence of nature's power was everywhere. Sand was saturated at least 30 feet inland from shore. Dune grass bent flat into submission created beautiful patterns in the smooth, sculpted sand. The finest nature artists, with all their talent, can't create the spontaneous beauty that nature does. Only nature can make a little slit in the piece of driftwood home for the pebble perfectly embedded there. What human could splay the smooth stones out as tiny moons orbiting an oddly shaped driftwood planet in the sand? Only nature could place the tree limb on the beach and decorate it with chains of mussel shells like garland forgotten on last year's Christmas tree. As much as I love the peaceful mornings of purple dawn over a calm lake, I'm drawn to this big water when it's roiled and angry. Beauty and power work as partners in humbling me and making me thankful to live in one of Wisconsin's coastal communities.
Wendy Lutzky is the Director of Education at the Wisconsin Maritime Museum. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
Historically, the Great Lakes have seen their fair share of destructive storms. Some of the bigger ones have caused legendary shipwrecks, many of which can be seen today if you don't mind diving in the frigid water.
Joining us now to talk about the world of shipwreck diving is Cal Kothrady, maritime artist, diver, and underwater photographer. Cal, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Cal, how did you first get started photographing shipwrecks?
I actually was a photographer for many years on land and decided to make the plunge so it were underwater. And I've been doing that for about 6 years now. The shipwrecks, just drawn to them, and I can't get enough of them.
And what are some of the Wisconsin area shipwrecks you've been able to see and come back with pictures of?
Some of the, I guess, more famous wrecks that people may have heard about are also photogenic. And one in particular would be the Rouse Simmons, which was a wooden sailing vessel, but it's also better known as the Christmas Tree Ship. Mm. There's been books written about it, and I believe there's even a play. But that was a great dive and a very picturesque schooner sitting on the bottom.
Now, I'm curious. You said you can't get enough of it. I will probably never be diving with a camera underwater looking at a shipwreck. What is it like to be down there under the water with what was obviously an unhappy demise for the ship and possibly lots of people on board? What does it feel like?
It's really kind of surreal. You're able to touch history. People can't on land walk into a time capsule that's literally been frozen in time for 125 or 150 years because they just don't exist without being a recreation in a museum. But as a diver, we get to visit some of these wrecks that have been virtually undisturbed for a century or more. And that historic connection is just incredible to feel and see the hand tools or the board, the decks that they walked on and earned their living on. It's incredible, and you can't get enough of it.
Are there personal effects of the people who are on board left, or has time sort of washed all of those away?
It really depends on the shipwreck, excuse me, but occasionally there's articles from their everyday life, frying pans, coffee pots, sometimes clothing, boots or hats, and that really hits home the personal connection that these aren't just vessels; these were workplaces and oftentimes grave sites for folks who were just trying to live their lives and get about from town to town or whatever.
Talking to underwater photographer Cal Kothrady about his photographs of shipwrecks of Lake Michigan and oceans as well. Let's get into the photography side of this a little, Cal. I mean, I imagine you can't take your standard terrestrial camera and just jump in the water with it.
No, you can't just put it in the water, but you can certainly buy what's called a housing, which is, I guess, a protective box that the camera goes in and usually allows you to have access to all of those buttons on your camera. And we also have strobe lights or sometimes what we call hot lights for video and things of that nature. And I actually run a little GoPro on top of my digital SLR camera housing so that when I'm shooting stills, which is what I care to do the most, I'm also shooting video as well.
And how different is it shooting video or photography underwater versus on land?
It's kind of tricky because the water... the clarity of the water typically does not allow you to get far enough away from these large shipwrecks. I mean, some of them are 2-3 stories tall off the bottom of the lake. So it's very difficult to image something that large. So you need a really good wide-angle lens that allows you to get close to the object so that you can see it through the water, yet still get as much of it in frame as possible. And a lot of the photography that underwater shipwreck photographers do is based on luck too. Sometimes the water is more clear than other times, and it's kind of like the lottery. You just have to get out there and dive, and if you don't dive, you don't get the opportunity to get the good visibility.
I looked at some of your photos, and in some of them you have another diver in by the ship. Is that partly so we get a sense of the scale?
Absolutely, yes. it gives the eye something to focus on, and definitely gives a sense of scale of these vessels. Some of them are smaller, some of them are larger.
Now, are there any shipwrecks out there that you haven't visited yet that would be on your list of dream shoots?
Oh, there sure are. There's a lot more that I haven't seen than there are that I have. The Great Lakes are basically a treasure trove of shipwrecks. Some estimates are as high as 10,000 among the shipwrecks within the five Great Lakes collectively. And it's just impossible to get to all of the good ones. There's not enough time or money, but it sure is fun checking them off the list one by one.
I guess if I were to go and try to do this, I wouldn't know where to look. Are these all really well mapped out and you just know where to go? Or are you finding some of these in some cases?
No, finding shipwrecks is a whole other skill set. I have a bunch of friends that are very good at that, and it takes a lot of pretty expensive equipment and a lot of time. So I leave that to others. I go to the ones that have already been found and that are shallow enough that I can get to them with my training. So a lot of the wrecks that I dive have been known for 30, 40 years. They were maybe found in the 70s, and they've been visited thousands of times. But for me, it's always refreshing to go back, and especially with a camera, and always try and get a better shot than maybe the one I already have in my collection.
Cal, thank you so much for talking today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Cal Kothrady, maritime artist, diver, and underwater photographer. We've been talking about shipwreck diving and photography in the Great Lakes. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Governor Walker's campaign announced a new proposal today to dramatically change federal labor unions if elected. We'll take a look at the details.
There's been a lot of coverage of Governor Walker's drop in the national polls since he announced his candidacy for president, and some have said his experience with the national media is partly responsible.
Walker has been criticized for changing his position on topics like immigration reform and border security after being pressed by national reporters, and has been perceived as being less confident on the national stage. One of our next guests points the finger at the Wisconsin media for being too easy on the governor.
We're joined now by Jimmy Anderson, a blogger for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Online and author of the piece How the Wisconsin Media Failed to Warn Us About Scott Walker. Jimmy, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And Mike Wagner is also with us today in studio. He's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back.
It's my pleasure.
So, Jimmy, let's start with you. Why do you say that the Wisconsin media failed the public when it came to coverage of Scott Walker?
You know, it was after I had read an article where they were interviewing some Republican campaign officials, and they were asking, you know, why had Walker been dropping into the polls, and they all pointed to his inability to answer questions in a straightforward way. And, you know, I took from there, and I was wondering, for me, it wasn't so much that Walker was, you know, running into gaffes or bumbles. It was just that it was a national media that was willing to ask him repeatedly difficult questions and was forcing him to answer those difficult questions and not just avoid the answers.
Okay, Michael, let's go to you with that. That's Jimmy's platform there, that the Wisconsin media did not ask the tough questions and hold Scott Walker accountable for answering them, and that may have led to his dip in the polls. What do you say to that premise?
Well, I would say that his dip in the polls is partly due to how little attention he's gotten. So part of it is that Donald Trump has taken up almost all of the oxygen on the Republican side, especially on TV. And when you're one of 17 running for office, you need to be in the news more. And when he has been in the news, it's been on issues that he's not used to answering questions about, issues related to foreign policy, immigration, things that you don't generally deal with as the governor of a state. And so they've been new issues. And so I'm not so sure that it's that the Wisconsin media haven't been asking him tough questions. They've been asking him questions about different things. And so I think that his drop in the polls is partially Trump, and partially there are lots of people running and no one's getting a lot of attention. His debate performance wasn't outstanding. And when he has been in the news lately, it's because he's had trouble answering questions about immigration, or at least there's been a media narrative that he's had trouble answering those questions.
Now, you've been watching elections for a while. How would you say that media coverage in national campaigns compares to state campaigns, running for governor, say, versus running for president?
Well, the range of questions you get is much wider. And it is much easier for something to go viral and be a national sensation when you're running a national campaign. And when news media are getting to know someone, they ask a lot more gotcha-style questions. You might remember a few months ago, Governor Walker goes overseas and is asked, does he believe in evolution? Does he think Barack Obama's a Christian? You know, stuff that, you know, is not quite as important to the governing of the country as other issues. Not that it's, you know, one's belief in evolution isn't important, but it's not as related to the day-to-day of being president. And so those were big kerfuffles in the media, but they don't have a lot to do with being president. And so he got those kinds of questions from national media, and those aren't the kinds of things most local reporters have spent any time asking him.
And Jimmy, in your article, you mentioned that Governor Walker's promise to help create 250,000 jobs is an issue that the Wisconsin media could have been more aggressive on. We're going to play a little clip of that pledge.
The measure that I'll face in 4 years is not, you know, what press release did I put out and whether or not my ads are kind of cool or anything like that. The real measure would be, what did I do to create an environment to help create 250,000 new jobs in the state of Wisconsin? Were we successful or not?
And there is that jobs promise. So, Jimmy, what would you like the press to have done differently in Wisconsin as the governor was making that a platform of his campaign?
Right. You know, if you listen to economists at the time, a lot of them were saying that the 250,000 jobs promise was a bit ridiculous. I mean, the recession had been really severe, and that growth was expected to be slow. I mean, he might as well have promised every Wisconsinite two jobs and a brick of moon cheese. But instead of treating that campaign promise as a mathematical impossibility, the Wisconsin media treated it as if it was some kind of reasonable campaign pledge. I think when you compare that to the national media, I mean, you can see the Washington Post with Jeb Bush's recent tax plan. They had criticized it, saying that it would add $3.4 trillion to the national debt over the next decade. They've criticized them about promising 4% growth. Or even when it comes to, say, Donald Trump's deportation plan, they pointed out the fact that it would cost hundreds of billions of dollars. I guess what I'm saying is that when the numbers don't add up, the media has a responsibility to say loud and clear that a politician is not being honest with you, and not just act like a bullhorn for a snake oil salesman.
We're talking right now with Jimmy Anderson, author of the piece How the Wisconsin Media Failed to Warn Us About Scott Walker. He's with the Journal Sentinel, and also talking with Mike Wagner, associate professor at UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. And Mike, what do you say to that? Was there anything in the coverage of the Wisconsin media there of that $250,000 jobs pledge that you think the media got wrong, should have pressed him on and called him out if they believed that to be the case, that the numbers were not reasonable?
Well, you know, first I would say it's right that when a candidate makes a bold claim, like we're going to end welfare as we know it or increase, you know, jobs in the state by 250,000, it's incumbent upon reporters to try to figure out, where does that number come from? What's the likelihood of that happening? It's also incumbent upon reporters to talk to other people to see what they think. And, you know, during the governor's first campaign, the news media did that. You know, Governor Walker's opponent was, you know, not at all absent from news coverage, saying that that goal was not terribly likely. And during the recall election and the governor's reelection, especially during the reelection, there was a lot of attention given to that kind of claim. Now, I think, you know, if we want to say the likelihood of a campaign promise coming to fruition, the judging that is the job of journalists. I think it's probably more the job of journalist sources. Journalists can't divine the knowledge of whether something's going to happen. And so if they don't have sources telling them it's not very likely, then it's hard for them to make that kind of report. But there were plenty of folks, especially on the opinion side, who said that that was a lofty, if very unlikely, goal to obtain. And as we know, the governor hasn't approached that goal.
And Jimmy, let's take a look at another one of the issues you're talking about here. You take an issue with the media's coverage of Governor Walker's stance on 20-week abortion. Now, here's a back and forth between Scott Walker and a Journal Sentinel reporter on that topic.
Do you believe abortion should be banned after 20 weeks?
Those are all things we'd have to look at in the future session out there.
Well, you support, I believe you co-sponsored a bill back in 98 saying abortion should be banned after 20 weeks. So I want to pin you down. Should abortion be banned after 20 weeks?
Again, I said those are all things that we'll certainly look at in the next
legislature. No, your personal view, not a legislative view, your personal view.
Well, I mean, I think it's a human life. And I think that's something that, people, regardless of where they stand politically, but those are things that we'll have to talk about in the next legislative session if it comes up.
Okay, Jimmy, there are back and forth between a reporter and the governor. What do you hear in that?
You know, it's encouraging to hear that kind of back and forth, but I think the question that needs to be asked is not so much about his personal beliefs, but how he would govern and how he would legislate. We didn't exactly, like, when he put out his campaign ad saying that he supported legislation that would leave abortion between a patient and his doctor, we've come to realize that that's not true with his 20-week abortion ban, taking the decision out of a woman's hands if after 20 weeks, even if there was something wrong with the fetus or even in cases of rape and incest. If the public had known that that was what Walker planned to planned to push forward when it came to legislation, I think it would have had a much bigger difference on the eventual election.
Okay, Mike, you heard the same clip there. What struck you about it?
Well, you know, first, I think I agree with Jimmy there. It's nice to hear the back and forth. It's nice to hear follow-up questions and saying, no, not you know, this kind of wishy-washy, well, we'll take a look at this, but let's pin you down. You know, at some point, it becomes obvious to someone, especially who's interviewed the governor on multiple occasions, like a lot of the local reporters have, he's just not going to say anything beyond what he says. And eventually they'll stop because, you know, he'll keep saying the exact same thing, even after kind of the annoyed, no, you've already said that, let's try to pin you down. And so it's challenging to ask follow-up questions when someone stays relentlessly on message. And so then you've got to find another source to tell you what the governor really thinks if you think that what he's said in your interview isn't what he really thinks.
Well, which brings me back to the British press corps and the back and forth that you mentioned about evolution, about the Wisconsin idea.
Right.
And that made headlines because it was a level of questioning, a different kind of questioning that the governor had been faced with. Do you think that that is one tactic that journalists maybe should take? Should the media here in the States take a page from the British media and take some of those side angle questions and get a fuller picture of the person, the politician, as it were? Or are we better to stay on track looking at the legislative issue?
Yeah, I think it depends on what the purpose of the story is. So if you were doing a long feature on the governor for the newspaper, you might ask other questions besides straight up policy questions or governing style questions. You might ask some of those kinds of questions. Or if you're doing a 30-minute television interview, you might try to ask questions that kind of reveal a little bit about the candidate, about the person, and how they make decisions, and also reveal to the audience whether this person answers direct questions or not, which is something that journalists can do just by asking direct questions and then showing on television or in the paper that they're not getting a direct answer. But I think it's probably best for local journalists to ask about local and state issues and how the governor is going to legislate those. And then, you know, I think as Jimmy points out in the op-ed and in his comments today, when you campaign saying one thing and govern doing another, that sort of thing ought to be discussed in the local media. I have a slightly different take than he does. I think by and large, when the governor has either broken with what he said in the past or pivoted in some way, it's been present in the news media. But I think, you know, people can disagree about how aggressive reporters should be in divining what's in a candidate's head when they're not answering the questions you want them to answer.
We're comparing media coverage of Scott Walker in Wisconsin and on the national stage and talking about whether coverage here at home was too lenient on the governor, as our guest Jimmy Anderson wrote in a recent piece.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think the coverage of Governor Walker here at home versus on the national stage has been drastically different? Do you think he's been having trouble lately with the national media? If so, why do you think that is? And how should the media cover a candidate's promises during a campaign? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our discussion with columnist Jimmy Anderson and UW-Madison media and politics expert Mike Wagner. First, a check of the latest headlines with Kristen Durst from WPR News.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're discussing state and national media coverage of Scott Walker right now, and we want to hear from you. Is the national media doing a better job, do you think, covering the Walker campaign than the Wisconsin media did? And do you think the coverage at home versus national coverage has been different? Do you sense a difference? How should the media cover a candidate's promises? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Jimmy Anderson stays with us. He wrote the piece, How the Wisconsin Media Failed to Warn Us About Scott Walker. That's on the Journal Sentinel website. Also with us, Mike Wagner, associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison.
We go to our callers now. We have Terry with us from Green Bay. Hi, Terry.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. What do you think?
Well, what I think, I used to be a former reporter radio and did a little TV production here in Green Bay. It is very, very hard to keep the governor, to get a direct message, because he does very well craft his messages to stay on point. And even with follow-up answers, he can only get so far. And I think that it's the media's job, really, to make sure that they explain the process of what they're asking and what answer they didn't get. And we're trying to get a direct answer. I think that needs to be explained in the process, that this question was asked, here's his reply, and here is what we were looking for and did not get a direct answer. I think that needs to be put out there a little bit more in explaining the process and trying to get an actual answer.
Okay, Terry, thank you for that insight there. And Mike, what do you think about that? Should the media get, I guess it's a little behind the scenes, you saying what we were going for was this, we didn't do that. I mean, you can't do it during an interview. That would be unwieldy. You can do it in print. But what do you think about that idea in general?
Well, I think that's a reasonable thing to do, is to say, you know, here's the story we were trying to cover, and here are the answers we got and the questions we got. And sometimes local reporters have actually pulled back the curtain. Jesse Apoyan of the Cap Times recently wrote a piece. The headline is something like A Field Guide to Governor Walker's Vocal Ticks, and it's about how he answers questions and how local and national reporters interpret the way he begins answering questions differently, and how that leads local reporters not to cover things national reporters cover. So if the governor, as a form of habit, says, yeah, absolutely, when he begins the answer to any question, which he does, local reporters ignore it, national reporters take off with it, and that's how we got into trouble about the, does he think that birthright citizenship still applies to the 14th Amendment. He still never actually gave a direct opinion that I've noticed in news coverage, but the way he started his answer was one that local reporters knew enough to know that he wasn't answering the reporter's question as much as he was saying to the reporter, okay, now I'm going to answer your question.
So what do you make of it?
The governor is a very smart politician and works very hard not to pin himself down when he can on a variety of issues.
Jimmy, what about that for you? Would that answer some of your critique here of the local media, if there was more of that behind-the-scenes look at what a reporter might have been intending with a question?
You know, I think that would be really helpful to be able to better understand, what it is that they believe Walker was trying to answer, or whether or not he was purposely evading answers. I think we've seen a lot of that more in the national media. There was a interesting piece in New York Magazine where kind of tongue-in-cheek, they said that Scott Walker had stumbled upon the cheat code for never having to answer campaign questions and saying that, you know, I'm not going to answer any hypotheticals. And so I think that's something that the national media has been doing a better job of trying to prod him to eventually answer those questions.
All right. Well, thank you for that call. Appreciate that, Terry. And we'll go next to Jeff in Madison. Jeff, hi.
Hi. Good afternoon.
What is your take on all this?
Yeah, so the one that surprised me, I was, well, a prejudice for just that the governor would be questioned by the national media about the six people who were convicted of crimes when he worked for the county, and two of them who took money from widows of veterans. And I thought that would be appalling, and they would push that agenda for a question about that.
Okay, Jeff. And Jimmy, what do you think about how that was handled?
You know, it's going. I'm sorry. Was the question about the two campaign staffers who were eventually charged with crimes?
Right, at the governor's time as county executive, and how that was picked up and ran with in the national media.
You know, I haven't really seen a lot going back to when he was Milwaukee County executive. I've seen a lot more focus on the national media on his current presidential campaign. There's been a little bit going back to. Going back to his campaign promise to create jobs and kind of the economy in Wisconsin. But, you know, I haven't really seen a lot being discussed from his time as Milwaukee County executive.
Well, thanks for that. And Mike, what about you? Is this something that the national media has not picked up on while it's focused on other things?
They haven't covered it very much. I mean, they've covered more of his first speech in Iowa, which got a lot of positive attention. Some of the missteps on immigration and foreign policy have gotten a lot of attention. His debate performance has gotten some attention. He's had a lot of bad coverage in the last week about his standing in the public opinion polls for the nomination. Usually, that kind of investigative digging from national journalists is something that doesn't happen until you're really one of the last couple of people standing. And so when there's 17 people, the coverage is more about where are the candidates on the particular issues that the Republicans, in this case, are talking about in the primary rather than their pasts.
We're talking right now with Mike Wagner, Associate Professor at UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication, and also Jimmy Anderson, columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about whether the Wisconsin media has been too lenient in its coverage of Scott Walker, and that the national media has not, at least according to Jimmy Anderson, done that same thing. He thinks that the national media has gotten some clearer answers. And Jimmy, I want to quote from your piece now. You write that it's not rudeness our reporters fear. It's the misplaced notion that if they are critical of Walker, that it means that they are biased. It's the end of your quote. Can you talk a little bit more about what you mean by that?
You know, I think it's a common refrain that we often hear that the media has some kind of liberal bias. And there was an interesting book written by two guys by the name of Mann and Ornstein. I think Professor Wagner has mentioned this book before, and they've written a book called "It's Even Worse Than It Looks," and they kind of discuss the politicization of or how politicized our politics have gotten. But they've also talked a lot about when it comes to the media, and they say that often reporters and editors try to seek safe ground by giving equal time to opposing groups, opposing arguments, and that they do so in order to avoid appearing biased. And I think that can be kind of dangerous. I mean, sometimes there are answers. Take, for example, during the debate when Walker said that we had a surplus versus an impending deficit. By not having to address that issue, by lying about that issue, we didn't get answers as to what he would do to deal with the deficit, and then we end up with surprises like this $300 million cut to the UW system. So I think that there can be a danger when, a reporter, in order to try to avoid what they may perceive as bias, by giving both sides equal weight to their arguments, and I think that could be a dangerous thing.
All right, well, and Mike, first of all, do you agree with that premise there again, that the Wisconsin media has been too afraid of appearing biased? And if you agree with that, there is a lot of political pressure, highly pressurized atmosphere right now, especially in the wake of Act 10. Would that be part of what you think could be going on?
Well, I think, first of all, just kind of speaking generally about reporters, oftentimes, you often see in stories two and only two sides, regardless of whether there are one or 11 sides, because you want to appear and when you be balanced and objective in your reporting. But sometimes that can lead to what Jimmy's talking about, something that, you know, we might call false equivalence, right? So 99% of scientists say climate change is happening, 1% say we're not so sure, and both of those get equal attention in the media. And that's a big problem. Sometimes, though, I think, you know, part of this is a selective reading and remembering of what's happened. So there was an interesting point in Jimmy's provocative piece that said that there wasn't a kind of calling out of Governor Walker's changing of his jobs goal. So Walker said, I promised to do this for 250,000 jobs, and then later amended his language to say he was doing a goal. And the story that gets linked to by Patrick Marley of the Journal Sentinel quotes Walker at length saying, this is a promise, I'm going to tattoo this on people's foreheads. And so the story quoted Walker saying this is a goal, but it also quoted Walker saying more than it was a goal, and it quoted Democrats saying, no, this was a goal. And so there were plenty of people pushing back. And so the question is, and I think this is a good question, how much airtime or column inches should you give someone who says something that might not exactly be true, but they're saying it and you want to tell your readers they're saying it? That's a tough question.
Well, Mike, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Jimmy, thank you to you as well. We've been talking to Jimmy Anderson, blogger for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel online and the author of the piece, How the Wisconsin Media Failed to Warn Us About Scott Walker. Also with us, Mike Wagner, associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison.